Hey, good morning, everybody. We got a smaller turnout, so try to like take up the first three rows. Let's just try to pull together here. Let's be a little bit cozier. And so if you could like occupy the first three rows, I think it just might help us all engage a little bit on something that could be a little bit cerebral for you. If you don't know what cerebral means, well, then you have a taste of what's coming. Okay. Yeah, come on up. Let's just get a little bit closer if we could. I know you know how to do that, Lance. Come on. Let's just get a little closer here. I even went to the classroom and grabbed a stool here just so we can kind of sit down, just get a little comfortable and try to focus. Try to engage your brain. Because this could really be enlightening for you. I know it has been for me. Okay, we're starting off, guys. So raise your hand if you personally have ever thought this, or if you have ever had somebody say something like this to you, especially when it relates to the things of Christianity and Jesus and the Bible. Okay, here's the first one. Raise your hand if you've thought this, or if somebody has said this to you, I won't believe it until I see it. Yeah, okay. How about, I believe in God. I don't believe in God. I believe in science. Yeah, or you know, somehow the science, I believe in science, not the supernatural. There's various versions of that. How about this one? Prove to me that God exists. Or the ornerier version, you can't prove that God exists. That's the ornerier version. Yeah, okay. Guys, yeah, we have experienced these things. And in fact, in this book that I've been reading this week by Paul E. Little, Know Why You Believe, he actually shares a story about how Bertrand Russell, and if you don't know who he is a fairly well-known, famous atheist philosopher. Well, he shares a quick, simple story of how Bertrand Russell got to that point of thinking. And so here it is. Here's the quick little story. The noted skeptic, Bertrand Russell, makes an astounding statement in his Why I Am Not a Christian book. He says that when he was a child, God was given him as the answer to the many questions he raised about existence. In desperation, he asked, well, who created God? When no answer was forthcoming, he says, my entire faith collapsed. Unfortunately, the author adds, his is a common experience, yet it fails to answer that burning question, who created God? Where did God come from? How do we know he's even there? Oh, yeah. Common. Very common. Indeed. In fact, so common that Bob and I felt motivated to do an entire series about living in light of eternity. It's what motivated us. And when we say that phrase, we're not saying, let's browbeat the faithful to be more sacrificial for God and the kingdom. That's not what we're talking about here. This is not some effort to get you to do more. No. This is trying to convince the faithful that they're really, seriously, for real. There really is a spiritual world. I'm not kidding. Okay, that's where we want you to get you guys. I mean, it's really real. We're not playing church anymore, is what this series is about. It's for real. Like, really. Okay? I hope you're getting what I'm saying. That's what this is about. Not only is there really is a spiritual world, but you really do have a soul, and you're going to connect with all of your senses in the spiritual world sooner than you think. And when you do, when I do, you'll be either really glad, I mean eternally grateful that you lived your life in preparation for that day, or you will be so filled with regret and remorse that you lived like this world is all that there is. You know, that kind of thinking is called materialism. Thinking that the only thing that's real is what's physical. It's called materialism. This is what the dictionary says about it. Materialism is a tendency to consider material possessions and physical comfort as more important than spiritual values. I pause while you read that statement for yourself. It hits just a little bit too close. When I say materialism, philosophically, materialism is this. The doctrine that nothing exists except matter and its movements and modifications. Now, there may only be a few of us in that line of thinking, but almost all of us struggle with that line of thinking. So that's the philosophical belief. Really believe. Materialism is what you really believe when you say things like, I won't believe it until I see it. That's what you're really saying. That nothing is real unless I can actually interface with it with my five senses. That's what you're really saying. And that seems to be the prevailing viewpoint among millennials, the younger generation today. That's the thing. But it's not just young non-Christians that are materialistic skeptics. No, it's Christians. It's young and old Christians that have had a materialistic influence on their lives. And so we fall into that category. We start living like all that's real is what can bring me physical comfort. Now, with today's little conversation, I want to make a disclaimer that it is not my goal to remove all doubts from your brain. Not only would that be an impossible task, you would have to die to achieve that. I don't want anybody to die here today. You see, I've said this before and I'm going to say it again. Doubting is good. Unlike wicked is good. I'm not talking about how the wicked is good. I'm talking about that doubting is good. That's what I'm talking about. We saw the last movie last night. Okay, so doubting is good. Now, why is doubting good? Boy, even in this book here, he brings up the benefit, the necessity for, even good Christian folk to be doubters. Yeah, let me read this to you. Okay, listen to this. Even committed Christians question their faith and wonder if it's true. Doubt can strike terror to the soul and be suppressed in an unhealthy way. Those who have grown up in Christian homes and in the Christian church find it easy to doubt the authenticity of their early experiences. From their youth, they have accepted the facts of Christianity solely on the basis of confidence and trust in parents, friends, and their pastor. As the educational process develops, there is a re-examination of how much of their early teaching they own for themselves. Such an experience is healthy and necessary to make our faith virile, alive, and genuine. It's nothing to fear or be shocked about. When a person, young or old, begins to question and God seems far away, doubts should be welcomed as a way to grow. Doubts welcomed as a way to grow. Doubt and questioning are normal to any thinking person. So, hey, there's your sign if you're, you know, you might mind, do I have a brain? Do I even have a brain? Hey, if you have ever had a doubt, guess what? You have a brain. Oot. Okay. Last part. Doubters have been known to see where troubling issues lie. After hearing answers to their questions, a decision is the next step. To make no decision is to decide against the Christian position. To not make a decision, to let your question become your conclusion, is to make a decision against the Christian position. Okay? Guys, that's what Bertrand Russell did. I asked, well, then who created God? When no answer was forthcoming, my entire faith collapsed. Collapsed on what? Some new revelation? Some scientific data? Some experience? No, by nothing. He didn't get a satisfactory answer, so he discarded Christianity. That's what he did. The very thing that this guy warns against is what he did. To not make a decision is to make a decision against Christianity. Guys, what I would like to have happen today is for us not to be a Bertrand Russell. Don't be a Bertrand Russell. Crying out loud. Instead, you're thinking, okay, he's going to have some extreme contrast to Bertrand Russell. What's he going to come up with? What great saint? What Billy Graham? What great guy is he going to mention? No, I'm going to tell you guys to be a doubting Thomas. Have you ever had somebody tell you to be a doubting Thomas? You heard it here first. Be a doubting Thomas. Because his doubts were reasonable. They were rational. People don't raise from the dead every day. He was right to doubt. And when his doubts were addressed, when they were answered, his response was, my Lord and my God. In John chapter 10. Now, of course, this was after Thomas, the apostle Thomas, received some clear objective evidence. I mean, you know, he saw Jesus. He felt Jesus. He heard Jesus. And it was based on that concrete evidence that, you know, that Jesus, he was convinced. Jesus rose from the dead. And since he did, that means it's all true. All of it. It's all true. Heaven, hell, angels, demons, eternity, it's all true. Everything that Jesus talked about was true because the guy rose from the dead. He was dead and now he's alive again. That makes him an authority on these things. And so he was convinced. For the rest of our time, I would like to give you three reasons to not be a materialist. Three reasons to not be a materialist. To not go down that road. To not let that philosophy influence your thinking in your life. Three reasons. And the first one, John 20 brings up. This incident, recorded by the Apostle John of the Doubting Thomas, we now call him, John 20, it gives us our first of three responses to the materialistic worldview, okay? And then we're given, remember, what the materialistic worldview is, that the only thing that is real is what can be perceived by your five senses. Okay, that one. The idea that I don't believe in God, I believe in science. Okay, in fact, that idea, I don't believe in God, I believe in science, that very sentiment, it exposes a lack of understanding of what science is. I mean, it's really, they show what a profound misunderstanding they have of science. I mean, if I were to ask you, what is science? What kind of definition would you give me? How would you respond if somebody asked you, well, what is science? What are you talking about? When you say science says this. How would you respond? About test tubes, laboratories, you know, guys in white gown, folks, you know, these white apparel, and you know, they're really smart anthropologists, you know, physicists and stuff like that. Well, those are examples, you know, but that's not what science is. That's not a definition. My kids could give you a definition, right? They could give you a definition, and you should be able to have a definition clearly thought through in your head. That way you'll know when somebody is being scientific in what they're saying or not. Science is the study of the natural world using one or more of your five senses, taste, sight, smelling, hearing, and touch, that you use to investigate the world, and you can repeat it in an experiment. You guys can say that. Of course you can. Science is the study of the natural world using one or more of your five senses, taste, sight, smelling, hearing, and touch, that you use to investigate the world and finish it. And you can repeat it in an experiment. That's the definition of science. And you need to be clear about what definition, what science is and what it isn't. Because science, by definition, and based on the very process of the scientific method upon which science is dependent, it's dependent on the scientific method. Based on that definition, it does not have the equipment to make any discoveries or make any claims about the spiritual, immaterial world. It can't even go there. It can't even talk about those kinds of things. I mean, its truth claims, science's truth claims, are restricted to the natural world. It can't even prove scientifically that Hannibal lived or that Napoleon Bonaparte lived. It can't, science can't prove that. All of history, all of Earth history, lies outside the definition of science. Which really, I mean, makes you think. When you think about science's claims to the origin of the universe, the evolution of life, I mean, they've just stepped outside their very own definition. You cannot literally repeat history in a laboratory. It's by definition unrepeatable. So, does that mean, since when, so again, let's put these dots together. That means when somebody says, I don't believe in God, I believe in science, they don't even know what they're talking about. They don't know what science is. It's kind of like, do I have that here? It's kind of like saying, science, yeah. Saying something like that is like saying, I'm going to use my telephone to measure radioactivity. For you millennials, this is what a telephone used to look like. Okay? I didn't want to have a picture of a cell phone because who knows, they might install a Geiger counter app and somebody says, well, I can do that with my cell phone. But not with this cell phone. This telephone does not have the equipment. It cannot measure radioactivity. Nor can science prove or disprove the existence of God or the spiritual world. It doesn't have the equipment to do that. It's not what it's designed to do. All right. So, let's find out where I'm at. Yep, there it is. So, does this mean, since you can't really use science to prove or disprove God because it doesn't have the equipment to do that, does that mean that science has nothing to offer, nothing to say about the spiritual world? Oh, no, not at all. Don't get me wrong, guys. Science has plenty to offer in terms of support or evidence to support or reject a spiritual world, the existence of God. But in and of itself, through science itself, it cannot prove or disprove the existence of God. It's not supposed to. I hope you guys get that part. Now, let's go back to what science can do. What can science do? What would you say if I were to say that based on what we do know and understand about science, there has to be a God. There has to be a spiritual world. I'm not saying in terms of scientific proof, it doesn't have the equipment for that, but in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt, what would you think? That if you really understand science and apply it appropriately, you will be forced to conclude there has got to be a God. Bold words. Bold words for some old aging pastor up there. Okay, so allow me to share why I think that's the truth. Some of you may remember the teaching that I gave from the series, I Am Convinced, where I said that if something exists now, then something has had to have always existed. Remember that? If this chair exists, if this stage exists, if you and I exist, then something has had to have always existed. How can I say that? Well, it's obvious that one of it is one of the most obvious philosophical proofs. It's an axiom, this Latin phrase. It comes from Latin phrase. Some old smart guy came up with this when he says, ex nihilo nihil fit. And people said, wow, where do you come up with these things? Well, that word means nothing comes from nothing. I know, pretty profound, right? Nothing comes from nothing. Or out of nothing, nothing comes. It's where we get our common phrase, you can't get something from nothing. We know this. Guys, if you ever have a period of time when you have absolutely nothing, then give it a million, trillion, billion years and you will still have absolutely nothing, because you'll never get something from nothing. Out of nothing, nothing comes. That's what that means. All right? So the philosopher Parmenides came up with that claim, and it has proven true ever since. Now, that idea can also be logically derived, that very same conclusion, that if something exists now, something has always existed, okay, can also be logically derived from the scientific law called the first law of thermodynamics. The first law of thermodynamics says the total energy of an isolated system is constant. Energy can be transformed from one form to another, but can neither be created nor destroyed. Okay, give yourself some time. Go ahead and look at that. Let it soak in. Somebody made a lot of money off of coming up with that. Read it. Think about it. Now, let me help you with a thought here. It needs to be understood that matter is a form of energy. Okay? This chair, this you, me, we're a form of energy. Matter is a form of energy. That's why it burns. Matter burns. It's energy. Okay? You and I, we are consolidated energy. Some people seem to be more of a ball of energy than others, I think. Okay, matter is a form of energy. So connect the dots. The first law of thermodynamics, especially that last line, would say that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Connecting that dots can neither be created nor destroyed. All right? If you consider that, matter can neither be created nor destroyed. What question is burning on your mind when you hear that statement? It begs the question. What is the question? If matter can neither be created nor destroyed, then what? Yes! Thank you, Lance! Good old Iowa State College graduate there. Then where in the world did it come from? Right? It's obviously here. Yep. Uh-huh. Since we exist, where did we come from? If energy, matter, can neither be created nor destroyed, then where in the world did it come from? Okay. So something exists now. That means something has always existed. You're never going to get something from nothing. Since we exist, something has always existed. What has always existed? Now you ask the skeptic, well, what do you think of that? You ask him, where did matter come from, huh? And he'll answer, well, that's obvious. Matter, in the form of energy, has always been there. It's eternal. Matter is eternal. You want to make God eternal? Well, guess what? I will go ahead and make matter eternal. Prove me wrong. Okay. I'll take him up on that. But first, let's let him have his day. Matter is eternal. And you could live out your life and sleep peacefully at night thinking you have a secure philosophical reason for your existence and for all existence. It hadn't have been for the fact that the first law of thermodynamics has a very annoying cousin. And his cousin refuses to leave, and he keeps you up at night because he will not shut up. What is the first law of thermodynamics, cousin? The second law of thermodynamics. Annoying cousin he is. And the second law of thermodynamics states, if any system is left to itself, it will go toward greater entropy. Entropy is basically the non-availability of energy. It's unuseful energy. Greater randomness, you could just use the word decay. There's a common example to help the non-scholarly academic types to really get a grip on what entropy is. Entropy is when you buy a brand new car, you sit it in your driveway, and after 75 years, you come back and expect it to still be nice, new, and shiny, and it's not. It's so totally not, guys. There it is. Second law of thermodynamics. Are you getting the idea? I mean, you just put the car out there in the driveway, and the elements, the wind, the rain, the sun, will start beating on it. Even the very essence of the atoms in the materials themselves will begin to give way to the ravages of time. Nothing lasts forever. Nothing made out of energy, matter, lasts. It eventually will decompose, randomize, decay. That's what the second law of thermodynamics says. Okay? And that's why we have a problem. If matter is eternal, matter is eternal. Remember that? You think God's eternal? I just say matter is eternal. Prove me wrong. If matter is eternal, then for eternity, it has been affected by its cousin, the second law of thermodynamics, and it's been wearing down and decaying to the point of useless energy, which they call heat death, and they predict that sooner or later the universe will experience a heat death. So in other words, to suggest that matter is eternal is to reject the most established law of science, which is the second law of thermodynamics. You'd have to reject that law in order to accept your idea that matter is eternal. Now, Harvard physicist, let's bring in a big brainy guy. Harvard physicist P.W. Brigham is quoted in Dr. Henry Morris's book, it's a classic, The Genesis Flood. And he talks about the first and second law of thermodynamics. Are you ready? The two laws of thermodynamics are, I suppose, accepted by physicists as perhaps the most secure generalizations from experience that we have. physicist does not hesitate to apply the two laws to any concrete physical situation in the confidence that nature will not let him down. And then Dr. Henry Morris adds in, it is not too much to say that these two laws provide the very foundation upon which the great superstructure of modern science and technology has been erected. All the various geological processes, as well as all other physical and biological processes, operate in accordance with these two principles. All right? We just went right for the jugular here. We're not bringing up all these other fancy little, you know, scientific ideas. We went right for the mother lode. That's the first and second laws of thermodynamics. So guys, to believe that matter is eternal, go ahead. Believe that if you want to, but you have to deny science in order to do so. Yeah. Matter, energy, it does not contain the properties to exist eternally. It cannot exist eternally. And yet, here we are. We're still stuck with the fact that something exists. We exist. How do you explain the reality of existence? Science, therefore, it pushes us to an answer, to look for an answer outside of the physical world. Are you catching this? The first and the second laws of thermodynamics, they push us to look for an answer for existence. And the answer cannot be found in the physical world. So where do you go? You go to the immaterial world, the non-natural world for an explanation. You look to the supernatural. It's the only place left to look for an answer to the question, why does anything exist at all? And I have an answer in that category. The answer of when you enter into or start investigating the supernatural world, I would like to produce a qualified text that says, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. A supernatural explanation. Now, if you've been tracking with what I've been laying down, then you might find yourself a bit confused. Not based on what I said, but based on that nagging question, well, if this stuff is true, then why do so many people still believe in materialism? Why do so many people reject the idea of God in the supernatural world if this is true? And I say to that, good question. That is a good question. Nothing I've said to you is new. None of this stuff is new. This stuff has been written down. The ideas, the laws, the conclusions, they've been around for centuries. They've been written in hundreds of books. So then why are there still materialists? And so many of them at that. Why is that? Well, it's not because they have an IQ problem. It's because they have an EQ problem. IQ is your intelligence quotient, your ability to understand big words and complex ideas. That's your IQ. Your EQ is your emotional quotient, how you emotionally react to big words and complex ideas. Okay, that's the EQ. Now, the author, again, of this book, Know Why You Believe, brings up this idea, and I kind of liked it. He says this, another cloud to faith, in addition to priori thinking, another argument he made earlier, is our emotional quotient, or EQ, as it is called. Whether our heritage is the United States or some other country, there may have been both erroneous or obnoxious examples of practicing Christians who have turned us off. Our EQ may go through the roof if we even hear the word Christian. Granted, we all have emotional hang-ups. Don't lose yourself. Yeah. We may all have emotional hang-ups of some kind, but awareness of them does help. On the other hand, we may have had zero contact with Christians or Christianity, no information, and no hang-ups. In either case, the more we can comprehend our own origins of thinking and feeling, the more objectively we will be able to consider the case for Christianity, as C.S. Lewis put it. So your EQ is how you emotionally react when you hear the words Bible, church, Christianity, yeah, Jesus. That usually gets a big reaction, unless it's used as a swear word. Jesus. When you hear someone say any of those words, you have, whether you perceive it or not, an emotional reaction. And it's either going to be good or bad, positive or negative. You had one. You may not even know it, but you did. And that emotional impulse will travel through your body and into your brain, where it can, if the negative reaction is strong enough, short-circuit your ability to think rationally about reality, specifically about God and the spiritual world. It will interrupt your otherwise rational senses because of your EQ. I'd like to read one last section in this book by Paul Little, Know Why You Believe, when he talks about this issue. The way he says, if Christianity is rational and true, why is it that most educated people don't believe it? The answer is simple. They don't believe it for the same reason that most uneducated people don't believe it. They don't want to believe it. It's not a matter of brain power, for there are outstanding Christians in every field of the arts and sciences. Belief is ultimately a matter of the will, and God has given us starting evidence with creation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and earth. A student once told me that I had satisfactorily answered all of his questions. Are you going to become a Christian? I asked. No, he replied. Puzzled, I asked, well, why not? He admitted, frankly, because it would mess up the way I'm living. And he realized that the real issue for him was not intellectual. It was moral. So guys, I am here to tell you that as we go through this series, as you go through your life, be a doubting Thomas. Ask questions. Express your doubts. Wrestle with your confusion. And as you do so, as you receive clear, objective, and rational evidence, then be like doubting Thomas. And stop doubting and believe. And say to the God who is there, my Lord and my God. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, I want to thank you that when you revealed yourself to us in the person of Jesus Christ and you wooed us into your family through faith in Jesus Christ. That you did not require us to put our brains on hold. You did not say, well, you can become a Christian, but you've got to be brain dead to do it. No. In fact, throughout history, Christians have called Christianity a thinking man's religion. You need to think. It invites you to ask questions. Your word compels us to inquire and to pursue and to discover. It's not a simple faith. And yet, it's not so hard that even a child can't understand it. These ideas that you brought to our attention this morning are not too hard. That if something exists now, something has always existed, that you can't get something from nothing. Everybody knows that, but for some reason, we've never really connected to the dots to realize that means there is a God, there is no other rational, reasonable option. So God, having made these things clear to us, I pray that you would settle our emotions down. Help us to calm down and for a moment think rationally. Use our heads. Why do we push Jesus away? Why do we reject the claims of the Scriptures? Why do we live like God's not there? Why do we make choices to reject your word, to sin, to live for ourselves and for the world? Why do we do that? Why do we do that? We don't have an intelligent answer. It's an emotional one, and it's real. Our emotions are real. And we need to examine what is going on in our heart. Why do we push you away? Pray you'd help every single one of us to be a doubting Thomas. And when we are face to face with the truth, we drop to our knees and we say, my Lord and my God. We can respond in no other way. Help us to be like that. And that is my prayer. In Jesus' name, amen.